No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give Their People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So you can call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. We have a very special guest tonight, so we'll try to take a few questions if we can. But Maria, how are you? I'm so excited. I know you are too.
Indeed. And I think we're going to have more questions than we're going to have time for.
Yeah. I'm sure.
Because of the venerable nature of our guest.
Look, we have Dan Rather tonight. This is so exciting. And it's also exciting for Maria Sanchez because it's her fifth anniversary. Our great research department tells me that you started on this show exactly 5 years ago and you've turned it into the great show that it's become. So thank you so much. Maria,
thank you, Michael.
And it's so appropriate that we should have such a special, special guest. Dan Rather, a man that needs no introduction, legendary news man in America, and we're so excited and honored to have him on our show tonight. Mr. Rather, are you with us?
I am indeed. It's my pleasure and honor to be with you again. And thank you very much for the opportunity, and congratulations, Maria, on your fifth anniversary. And
thank
Senator,
you.
I'm pleased to hear you say you have a large and expansive research facility. You mentioned that your research capability.
Yes. Our large and expansive research department is named Karen. She does it all. Maria and I have fallen apart. And before we start, let me just tell you, I've had some great experiences in this job, but I've never had one any greater than spending a day with this gracious, brilliant man, watching President Obama, not at the time, candidate Obama, giving his acceptance speech. So it was really a thrill, and we're so excited to have you back. To be back again with you. Let me start out right at the top. You recently tweeted, "I suspect if Washington D.C. was a Republican stronghold, Mitch McConnell would long ago have made it a state," which acknowledges that the fact that our battle for equality has become strictly a partisan endeavor. In your opinion, is there anything we can do to make D.C. statehood more palatable to Republicans, as no state has ever entered the union without bipartisan support? What do you think?
Well, first of all, let me back up for just a moment, Senator, and say it's really a genuine pleasure to be with you and Maria tonight.
Thanks.
And we'll get on. I do want to answer your question, but I've always felt very grateful to you that you were of tremendous help to me and to my grandson Martin in 2008.
What a great guy. Where is Martin now? Is he in, I don't want to digress here, but is he in college now?
He's been to college. He graduated right at the top of his class at Rice University, and then he got his master's degree at Columbia, and he's about to go off to law school. That will bore the heck out of your audience. We want to get to the meat of the thing, but you'll get the scene. This is 2008, And I have been on the floor of every political presidential nominating convention, major party in this country, since 1956. And wow. I was eager to keep that string going, but I had no credentials to get on the floor of the Democratic Convention in 2008. And you, Senator, stepped in and were just heroic, in my view and in Martin's view, and arranged to get us on the floor, and I shall never forget that. Now, to your question, and I'm sure your listeners are saying to themselves, well, these guys finally get on the subject, so we'll finally get on the subject. And you answer your question. I think that the only thing that I have to suggest is to keep on keeping on, that this is a matter of extreme importance to the long-range future of the country, in my opinion clearly labeled. And your question is, well, what can you do to make it happen where the District of Columbia gets its statehood? Number one, while the battle has been long up to now, my guess is it's still a long, tough battle ahead. And I think the more people who can be reached with the argument of fairness, the strongest card that those who support D.C. statehood have is what's fair, what's right. And you and I have had these conversations before about the basic decency and fairness intention of the vast majority of Americans, whether they be Republican or Democrat or mugwump or whatever, anything else. Americans overwhelmingly want to do the right thing. They want to do the fair thing. They want to do the decent thing. And so the more people who can be reached, they would ask to say, look to your conscience, and here's the case for statehood. You answer to your conscience. The more often you can do that, on the wider scale you can do that, I think will put you getting closer to your goal. I will say that, you know, one of the problems that I find in talking to people about this, that a lot of people who I think would be in favor of fairness and the decency to do the right thing never get past the idea that, well, it's a Democratic ploy. It's a thing put together by the Democrats for Democrats because they want they figure D.C. will vote Democratic in any future election. That's, as you know, is the strongest argument that's put forward against it. I know the argument that should demolish that, but so often it never gets down to, well, let's set that aside for a moment. And let's look at some other factors. That's the best I can do. It's a tremendous job. And, you know, I salute you that you've been unrelenting. You've been persistent over the years in making this uphill battle. I have no doubt that the time will come when the District of Columbia will be granted statehood. Whether it happens in my lifetime or not, I wouldn't want to venture a guess. As you know, I'll soon be 89 years old. And I don't even buy green bananas, much less talk about what might be so fast in years coming.
Well, you know, Mr. Rather, a long time. Go ahead.
I'm a lifelong Republican, and I have never, ever had a problem with D.C. for statehood for the exact reasons that you just mentioned. Get the politics out. Let's talk about what's right, what's fair, what's equitable. And then we can worry about how the chips are going to fall after that happens. And when I say that to people, as you so eloquently said, they're like, you know what? I guess it's we need to be bigger people then, don't we?
Yeah.
But exactly so. And by the way, as both of you know, because you know your history, that many of these same arguments were made when the question of Hawaiian statehood came up. Mm-hmm. Many of the same questions came when the question of Alaska statehood came up. You know, I will say that, and perhaps I don't want to get either of you into more controversy than you naturally get into by fighting this cause. But I do think we need to bring out what could be called kind of the elephant in the room. And that is that the District of Columbia is seen as overwhelmingly, predominantly a place where only two general categories of people live. One, quote, government bureaucrats, unquote, and then two, people of African-American heritage. And the fact that the District of Columbia has a a large percentage of its population is of African American heritage, is one of those things that a lot of people don't want to acknowledge, but it is one of the reasons that a lot of people simply oppose it without even thinking it through. It's a matter of, as so much of else in our country is, there's an inherent racism. I don't want to play the race card, as quote unquote people sometimes accuse of doing, but you can't discuss the problem of statehood in the District of Columbia without taking that into effect.
That's absolutely the case. And you know what? You write in your book, and you have this amazing book that everybody should read. It's an easy read, and it's so inspirational, What Unites Us. But you write in that about civil rights leader Medgar Evers, a man you admired, who was focused on disenfranchise of black voters. You say he didn't hate white people. He hated the system and the elected officials who manipulated it, and that he saw most of his white neighbors as decent Christian people who were just horribly misguided on the issue of race. What do you think Evers would say today with the rise in the movement for black empowerment? Are we still horribly misguided on race, or is there a new malevolence that's arisen as a backlash to the progress that African-Americans have made? Do you think that this is new, or is it just the same old, same old? We see them trying to block voters and do all sorts of things.
Well, I think it's a version of same old, to use your phrase. It's a 21st century version of that. But let's also note that the country has made some terrific strides. I can even use the word tremendous strides in trying to address racism. We have a very long way to go. We can never achieve perfection, but we have to understand that we have made some progress. The Medgar Evers that I knew in the early 1960s, when I was covering Dr. Martin Luther King and the fairly early stages of the civil rights movement, which brought me to meet Medgar Evers, who was doing heroic work in Mississippi, and who was assassinated in front of his wife and children because of it. That Medgar's attitude of saying, look, I don't hate white people. I hate the system, and I hate the people, the political structures that refuse to let us vote. And it was very difficult to vote in Mississippi at that time. And by the way, that's one of the things that's improved in terms of race relations in this country and racial fairness in the country, is that now, at the very least, people of African-American heritage can vote in Mississippi. But we don't need to digress here. Again, I think that for those who ache and yearn and work for statehood for the District of Columbia, that my only point is that you have to, again, constantly appeal to people's basic decency, their intention to their yearning to be fair, and say, look, if race is one of the things we have to discuss, let's discuss it, and let's discuss it in the American way of bringing things out in the open. What are you afraid of by giving statehood to the District of Columbia and the many people of African American heritage who live there? What are you afraid of? Because very often, racism is based on some deep-seated fear.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's correct.
So in your book, What Unites Us, which you published in November of 2017, and as of today, it's the number one bestseller in civil rights and liberties on Amazon. So talk about legs. You have to feel somewhat prescient with what some of the things that you wrote about, is that we are stuck in the purgatory of tolerance. We were talking about inclusion. We're still largely segregated as a society, and our political divisions increasingly fall along the lines of race. The conversations that we're having today, you were writing about, I know you started writing before it was published. So is it the wisdom that you gained with your 44 years on CBS News that had you, I mean, you almost had like a crystal ball here with your book?
Well, as the senator can tell you, Maria, and tell the audience, I have no crystal ball, that's for sure. By the way, I have learned over the years that he who tries to make predictions off the crystal ball learns to eat a lot of broken glass. And I've eaten more than my share of broken glass. So it was a crystal ball, and it certainly wasn't wisdom. I started writing the book in early 2016, but it wasn't a matter. You know, I'm very proud and I'm very grateful. I had an opportunity to work in CBS News for 44 years, and yes, I went a few places and saw a few things and learned a few things. But I don't have any wisdom. That I can be dumb as a fence post about a lot of things, but I'm at least smart enough to know what I don't know. And there's a lot I don't know. I'm not the smartest guy around. I'm a reporter who spent nearly all of my adult life trying to figure out what's going on and where things were going. So, yes, the book turned out to be somewhat prescient, which is one reason that, although it was published 2.5 or 3 years ago, that it still has some vibrancy now, is that some of the things I talked about in the book became even more imperative as the Trump years advanced. For example, you mentioned the word tolerance and the phrase I used, the purgatory of tolerance. You know, and sometimes, again, people, decent intending people, sometimes just don't think things through. They just don't think about things. And in terms of the difference between tolerance and inclusion, mm-hmm. which is very important, we don't need to get into a dictionary definition. What we do know is that in terms of race relations, tolerance is the minimum. That's the minimum in a constitutional republic based on the principles of freedom and democracy such as we have. It's tolerance. Racial tolerance, religious tolerance, tolerance of people of different ethnic makeup is absolutely essential, but that's the minimum. Tolerance is where you say, okay, I can tolerate this. I'm not going to resist this. I can tolerate it. But tolerate is one thing. Inclusion is another. Inclusion is the next step. Inclusion includes tolerance. Says not only am I tolerant, but I want to include people of different races, different religions, different ethnic makeup. And that, it's very important, again, in a society such as ours, that we understand the difference between tolerance and inclusion, and that we're always looking toward inclusion, not just tolerance, but inclusion. Now, this comes into play when we talk about seeking statehood for the District of Columbia. It's one thing to say, well, okay, we tolerate people in the District of Columbia. They're able to vote. But when it comes to including them in the full rights of an independent of a state, then we're not going to include them.
Well, and you also make the argument for the LGBTQ plus communities eloquently in your inclusion chapter in your book, which I appreciate. Yes. Because that too has become. But as far as prescient, may I say something? Because we're waiting to watch the 60 Minutes Leslie Stahl interview with President Trump and Vice President Pence. And in your book about the press, you say the role of the press is to ask hard questions and refuse to be deterred. Our founders understood that long-term accountability is more important than short-term stability, which speaks exactly to what's going on with, quote, the fake news.
That is true. That is true. I myself have not seen the 60 Minutes piece. I think even as we speak, I could be. But I haven't seen it. I've only seen it, very small snippets of it. But the overall point definitely holds.
And apparently that was the problem, that she was asking some tough questions. We on the West Coast don't get it for several hours yet, but that's why I said we're dying to say. And have you seen, I know now from CBS News, you founded the News and Guts, which you're the founder, president, and CEO of. What's the difference to you between traditional news that you cut your teeth on and are the one of the most renowned journalists in the world, between doing that and doing what you do now with the News and Guts?
Well, I'm really glad you asked, because in the present environment in which there's a lot of confusion, and which has led to a lot of chaos about what is news, what isn't news, how the news has changed over the years. So let me just take a moment in answering your question, that I spent most of my career, I trained myself, I tried to get enough experience to practice as a full-time professional journalist for over half a century, And what I was attempting to do at that time in my career was be what I call an honest broker of information. What I was trying to do, others will have to attest of how well or how badly I did it, was say to myself every day, what am I out here trying to do? And the answer was, I'm trying to get the facts, and I'm trying to analyze the facts, because we know you can know all the facts and still not know the truth. And the ultimate goal is to get as close to the truth as possible and to tell it. That's what journalists do. We try to get as close to the truth as possible and tell it. And to do that, you gather facts, you connect the dots of the facts, which is called analyzing, and that's what you would call a straight reporter. For most of my career, that's what I intended to do. There are other forms of journalism besides fact-gathering and analysis. One other form of journalism is commentary, in which you say, okay, we've looked at the facts, you've heard the analysis, now I'm just going to comment on the news. Then there is, and give opinions, if you will, based on looking at the facts and the analysis. And then the next category is editorializing. And the difference between an editorial and commentary is an editorial urges the course of action. An editorial, for example, would say, vote for X and not Y, or vote for the bond issue or don't for the bond issue. An editorial urges a course of action. Commentary does not. Now, at this late stage of my life, and let's face it, I'm on the backside of the mountain now, and frequently have another journey on my mind, that I still do reporting. I look for facts and look for analysis. But basically what I try to offer is commentary on current situations, with the goal being I'm trying my best to give some context and perspective to the news, particularly some historical context. Again, you know, that's what I'm trying to do. Others will have to judge how well or how poorly I do it. But that's the difference between what I do today and what I tried to do for more than 50 years, that I hang out a sign and say, folks, I'm trying to comment on the news, and I do so on social media.
Since my illustrious co-host has brought up crystal balls, I can't 9 days before an election let you go without asking this question. The polls put Vice President Biden ahead in most of the critical battleground states, and he's got a double-digit lead nationally. However, to quote that brilliant political sage, Yogi Berra, it feels like deja vu again. Does it feel that way to you? As Democrats, do you think that we could be surprised again? Because we all thought we were going to win last time.
Well, that's a good question. And the answer, I think, is that every election is different. No two elections are alike. As you know, Senator, being around politics as long as you've been, no two elections are alike.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think where we are, I'm not much a believer in polls. And even for people who do believe strongly in polls, as you know, they're a snapshot of a moment in time. And we still have, over a week to go. Well over a week to go. And overnight's a long time in politics. A week is forever. And it is in past elections, a lot of people haven't made up their minds until the weekend before their actual vote. Or in many cases, people don't make up their mind until they actually go in the polling booth. I think it's very clear that Vice President Biden is in a very good position to win the election and possibly win the election overwhelmingly. By avalanche proportions. There is that possibility. However, what I find is, and particularly among Democrats, many Democrats seem to eliminate any possibility of President Trump winning re-election, and that goes too far for me. There are several paths through which Donald Trump can repeat his 2016 victory, and that is that, you know, Biden wins the overall national, gets more votes nationally, but in certain key electoral vote states, that Trump prevails again. And so I'd be very wary if I were a Democrat pulling for Joe Biden to get overconfident. Biden can win, and I expect him to win, but there are several paths through which Donald Trump can win.
But, Mr. Rather, what is your take on the, they say there's about 60 million early voters have been submitted already. What do you think that might portend for the results? Because they say that's record-shattering.
Yes, it may very well be record-shattering. We'll have to see, because many of the people who voted, you know, there are new ways and more ways now to vote other than just showing up on vote day. But what this may portend is a record voter turnout. I think a record voter turnout would benefit Joe Biden. I don't think there's any doubt about it. But one of the things, and I'm glad you raised this question, you say, well, what's going to be the effect of it? One effect is going to be that counting the votes will be slower. And the idea that it may be days, maybe even weeks, before we know exactly with any precision what the vote count is, because counting all these early votes and particular votes by mail, there's so many more than has ever been the case before. In some jurisdictions, for example, in some parts of New York, it's expected there will be 6 to 10 times as many mail-in ballots this time as there's ever been. That tells me that unless it's an overwhelming victory, one way or the other, having said that it's likely to be for Biden, we may be on what's called election night, just sitting there and saying, well, listen, it's going to be a long while before we know how this game comes out. And I think the public has to be prepared for that, because there'll be a lot of many propaganda efforts to sway public opinion. Get the picture. It's election night. It's unclear who has won. It would not surprise me to see President Trump just jump out fairly early and say, listen, I've won. It's a victory for me. And we could get into a very chaotic and, if we don't watch it, even dangerous situation by expecting too many results too soon. It may take a while, and we should be prepared for that.
I understand your point about volume. Sorry, Michael, I just wanted to follow up. But my understanding, too, is that some states like Pennsylvania, they're going to start counting the absentee ballots at 7 in the morning on election day. And ordinarily, we used to wait until the polls closed. And Florida, they can count their mail-in ballots as early as 22 days before the election. So I was hoping that meant that we would have a better take on what's actually happening based on these unprecedented numbers that we're seeing. 60 million votes could be counted. Of course, it varies state by state. I only just threw out two examples because Pennsylvania is so important, especially. And if they can start counting at 7 a.m. and not wait till the polls close, that's a good leg up on the process, at least, or the results.
That is. And it is true that some votes are being counted well before election day. It just depends on how big the vote is. I'm just preparing people. If it's an absolute avalanche and a much larger number of people voting than we've ever had before, depending on the state, and you're quite right to say, you know, state by state, some states are better than others, the system just gets overwhelmed. There aren't enough people to be involved in the counting and get overwhelmed with it. I hope none of this happens, but I think we have to be prepared for it happening in some places.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, let me ask you a question based on your wealth of experience. Many people said in 2016 that they thought President Trump would feel the mantle of his office and change his demeanor, becoming more presidential. That really hasn't happened, in my opinion. You've interviewed every president since Dwight Eisenhower, what do you think is different about Trump, which has kept him from becoming, quote-unquote, more presidential over the past 4 years? Do you think there's something about him that's different than all the other presidents that you've interviewed?
Well, number one, and this is in no particular order, but number one, he is the only president of what we will call the modern presidential era, at least, and I think the only president in all of our history, but certainly in the modern president's era, he is the only president who has taken the attitude that he wants to, he's president and he wants to benefit those people who voted for him and those people who supported him. He has never seen himself. This was hard for me to believe when he first came to the presidency, but now 3.5 years into it, we know that he has seen himself as president of the people who voted for him and who support him, not as the country as a whole. And that's a vital, an all-important difference in the attitude other presidents have brought to the office. Other presidents have been very political. Other presidents have done all kinds of nefarious things to support their reelection. But we haven't had someone who openly and just bluntly says that, in fact, I'm here as president of the people who voted for me and supported me. The attitude being, I'm sorry to put it in this language, sort of the hell with the rest of you. That's something new to the, certainly, as I say, in the modern president's era. Number two, I believe it's true that he is the first and only president who does not believe in the foundation institutions of the country that provide check and balance. That, you know, Richard Nixon, who, let's face it, ran a widespread criminal conspiracy out of the Oval Office himself and lost the presidency because of it. But even Richard Nixon basically believed in the necessity of the institutions of the country, the independence of the courts, for example. That when the Supreme Court ruled against Richard Nixon, he accepted, well, that's the Supreme Court, and they ruled that. But Donald Trump has demonstrated repeatedly that he does not believe in the basic institutions of the country. He's criticized the courts. He's criticized individual judges. He's lambasted the Congress. He has tried to have a very authoritarian presidency, which is to say, I'm the most powerful person in the country. Yes, he's the most powerful person in the country, but there's supposed to be a system of checks and balances on his power. He's demonstrated repeatedly he doesn't believe in those checks and balances, and that's a big difference between his presidency and any other of my lifetime, and I would argue any other in the whole history of the country.
I would like to bring up to our listeners, in case they're not familiar with, when, if this is pre-COVID, of course, in February in New York, you debuted Dan Rather's Stories of a Lifetime. Can you tell our listeners about that experience and what that was like for you? Because I understand in some of the interviews you had, you were a little nervous.
Well, this was a company called Audible, which is perhaps the best known commercial company dealing with audio events. They wanted to do something which I had some reservations about, but finally said, okay, I'll do it. And that is to go off-Broadway to a theater, a live theater, off-Broadway theater, and do two nights in which I talked about some of my experiences, everything from experiences growing up to experiences covering wars and presidents, for that matter. And this was what it entailed was walking out on stage and being by yourself. Nobody else is on the stage, and trying to hold stage for about an hour and 20 or 30 minutes, telling stories of a lifetime. Those stories were recorded from that theater performance and then made available through Audible, through the company, as a recording, and that you can subscribe to their service and get the recording. I had never appeared in theater before. I've done public speaking, but that's a different thing than putting on a theatrical performance. Mm-hmm. And it is true, before going on stage, I can't say I had stage fright, but I had said to myself, well, this is a brand new experience, and I'm a little bit nervous with it. But I'm told, it's an old cliche, but I think it's true, if you aren't a little bit nervous about it, you probably aren't going to do a good job. But it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, trying to hold a theater crowd by yourself on stage as a theater performer. It was an interesting experience. I don't expect to do it again.
Well,
one and done, are we?
I've just got to tell you that the time I spent in a stadium with Dan and his son and his grandson, everybody came up. Everybody came up to him to tell him how wonderful they thought he was. And, you know, so many people had stories about how they had watched him as they grew up and what an important person he was in their lives, even though he didn't know them. And I want to tell you, this man was gracious and accepting and engaging with each and every person that came up. It was just remarkable. So I can't imagine you being nervous on stage. But let me ask you, as Democrats, we're totally focused on getting President Trump out. You quote de Tocqueville saying that the greatness of America lies in her ability to repair her faults. Win or lose, we will still have a country that's divided. How can we come together and repair our discord and address our faults? Is it by focusing on what unites us? Is that the basis for moving forward?
I think it is. And to answer your question, the first thing we need to do is listen to one another. That we do have deep divisions. And however the election goes, the number one priority for the next presidential term is to try to heal the very deep divisions in the country. This will not be easy. And I know some people listening to this will say, well, if it's Donald Trump, there's no chance. I don't think we can be that pessimistic about it. Certainly if Joe Biden is elected, his number one priority is to listen to people who voted against him. Listen to some of the people who have opposed the Democrats and say, how can we reach common ground? We have to listen to one another. I would say this is particularly true in trying to deal with racism. And if you believe in the imperative of anti-racism, it is we have to listen to one another. So we have to listen to one another. The president has to see himself as president of all the people and listen to very even points of view to which he's been unalterably opposed. We have to listen to one another. And I do think we have to say to ourselves, okay, we disagree about a lot of things. On what can we agree? I think we can all agree on one person, one vote, the sanctity of voting. We have a lot to demonstrate in terms of improving our voting process. But I think the whole country overwhelmingly, that's one thing, you know, the right to vote. Equal justice under the law. I think overwhelmingly most people agree that what we want to do is have equal justice under the law. And on down the line, we want to have inclusion, not just tolerance, but inclusion. Not everybody will agree, but I think overwhelmingly the majority of people in the country agree. Empathy. Being empathetic about other people, having in our minds say, look, we don't pity people who are less well off than we are. What we try to do is imagine what it would be like to walk in their shoes and address it. That there are basic things of which we can agree on overwhelmingly as a majority of people. But so often in these past 4 years, and I would say it goes even beyond that, our divisions keep going deeper and deeper. We don't listen to one another. We don't emphasize those things on which we can all agree and say to ourselves in the spirit of the following. Say to somebody who disagrees with you, listen, you and I can disagree about 100 things. Can we find one thing that we can agree on and work together on and then use that to maybe find some others and build a higher ground. That's the only way back. It'll be long. It'll be very hard. I can only hope and pray that whoever is president after this November 3rd has that very much in mind.
You know, can I read you really quickly? Somebody just sent this in, and I think it's just such a lovely sentiment, and it really expresses my feeling about you, and I'm sure many other people. But Maura from Maryland sent in the following. Following Mr. Rather on social media has been like a beacon of light and hope over the last 4 years. I'll be forever grateful to him for sharing his thoughts and his calming voice throughout the storm. Thanks, Maura. I agree with you 100%. Do you have a question, Maria?
I just want to make as an aside that you founded your News and Guts on Facebook on my birthday, January 5th, 2017. Yeah. When I saw that, I was like, ooh. It's, of all the places that you covered stories in the world, from, say, Vietnam to Afghanistan to wherever you were sent, what was your feeling? What does it feel like to be in harm's way and yet know that you're there to get to the truth, as you said, to find out what is the story and then to share that with us?
Well, first of all, I really appreciate your kind words, and I appreciate your question. Look, if one aspires to be a world-class journalist, if that's your goal, and it was always my goal, I've never yet quite achieved it. And I don't mean that by some false humility, that I know very well all my faults and shortcomings. But if your goal is to be a world-class journalist, then on some days, in some ways, danger is your business. And because I aspired to be, I wanted to be a good journalist. I wanted to be a world-class journalist. Then I did adopt, on some days, in some ways, danger is my business. So you go to Vietnam, you go to Afghanistan, you go to Iraq, you go to, for a long time, you answer the sound of gunfire anywhere in the world. And yes, many times there are risks, and you have to make a decision, all kinds of decisions. Do you go a little further and take additional risk, or do you kind of fall back? But I will say that what always helped me is, and I'm pausing only because I don't want anyone to take this the wrong way, the power of prayer helped me, and also an attitude of, if it's my destiny to go today, then I'll go. If it's not my destiny, then I'll survive this. Every journalist has their own personal ways of getting through the dangerous situations, but those were among the ways I got through them. And always that I always felt take the risk if the story's worth the risk. But don't be foolish. There's a difference between being just foolish and mustering enough gumption to go ahead and take a risk and do what you have to do.
Well, because you also were not just having this huge responsibility for us as a country and a world, but you have a wife and a son and a daughter. So it wasn't like I'll just do what I need to do. You had other people at home that love you and needed you. And by the way, you've been married since 1957. Congratulations. I don't know how you guys did it with all of that you were traipsing around the world and all, but it worked. Any advice?
Well, I can't give any advice. I will say, and your point is very well taken, Jean and I had our children, fairly early when she was, 22 and 24, and when I was 25 and 26 or 7. And by the time that I got to CBS News, we had two children. And this always figures into your thinking when you're going to go someplace where it's dangerous and you say, my profession is calling me. On the other hand, you have a family. And Jean was always very supportive of what I wanted to do. It is one of the keys to staying together. Anybody who's been married for any length of time knows nobody gets through marriage unscathed. Everybody's going to have their difficulties. But back to your point, that it was, yes, there was always concern about family, and I always had it very much in mind. And looking back on it, I probably made too many decisions to go ahead and cover the story and not stay home. I can be faulted for that. But I will say that Gene and both my son and daughter, my son Dan Jack and my daughter Robin, were always very supportive. And the worst of it, the worst of it was when just after the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan in late 1979, and I said in early 1980 I was going to Afghanistan, that my wife Jean and my daughter Robin both took me aside and said, you know, Dad, we don't have a good feeling about this. Frankly, what they said was, we're afraid, if you go, we're afraid you won't come back. That was a pretty heavy number, actually, a very heavy thing. Yeah. But the record is, I went ahead and went anyway, and with a little luck and God's grace, got in and got back out. But I would say that was the toughest time, but there was some version of that on many occasions. When the kids were still home and, you know, we had what used to be called a nuclear family.
Well, you know, I just want to make a comment here because this has always bothered me. And I think I speak for Maria in saying that we are both people of great faith. And the first politician I ever worked for was Jimmy Carter, another man who arguably may not have been the best president, but he was certainly a man of great faith. And it's always bothered me that as liberals, it seems that sometimes we have a hard time talking about that. And I don't know why that is. I think that, you know, I know Maria is a regular churchgoer, and I was a youth group leader in my church and on the vestry of my church. And I have a profound belief in God, and it bothers me sometimes that liberals don't embrace that. Look, I have a question from Karen in Buffalo. This is a great one. Do you write your own tweets for your 1.5 million followers? 1.5 million followers. I've got 1,000 followers. So I find that remarkable. Do you write your own tweets?
Well, the answer is yes. I have help. I've worked with a wonderful team of people at my News and Guts organization. And everybody leans in and helps when people have ideas. And I work closely with Elliot Kirshner, who helped me write What Unites Us. It's a team effort. Nobody can write that many tweets without being a tweet effort, team effort. But in the end, the answer is yes. I write tweets. My name is on them, and nothing goes out without my writing, rewriting, looking at it. And, yes, I write my own tweets. I recognize that there are people who hire people to do nothing but write the tweets. That's not the way it works with our team. I have a team of people that we produce documentaries, we make films, we do books, we do a lot of things. But I enjoy social media, and I enjoy the idea that, you know, I take ideas from anybody, anywhere, and kind of try to put them in my own words. I particularly like it when we can add a little humor.
Well, since you brought up your staff, let me take this opportunity to thank Alex Van Ansom, who was very helpful in arranging all this. Thank you, Alex. We really appreciate your help. Maria?
Yes.
Next question is yours.
Mr. Rather, since we're running a little shorter on time, I'm going to ask you, of the interviews that you conducted with Martin Luther King Jr., Dr. Nelson Mandela, Saddam Hussein, and covering President Kennedy's assassination, which would you care to share with us was the most significant for you?
Well, you know, I appreciate the question, and I'll try to answer it. But keep in mind that I was so lucky and blessed for so long, and I could name 15, any one of 15 interviews and say, you know, it was one. But if I have to pick one interview, I would say covering Dr. Martin Luther King on a day-in, day-out basis in the early 1960s changed me as a person and changed me as a professional. And so if I have to pick one interview for over the years, Nelson Mandela was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I interviewed him several times. But in answer to your question, if I have to pick one, well, at least for this night, I'll say Dr. Martin Luther King.
And can you say how he changed you? Do you mind?
Well, I grew up among institutionalized racism. I grew up in Texas. I was born in 1931. Texas in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, on into the 60s, had institutionalized racism. You can say, well, it wasn't as bad as Alabama, Mississippi, or South Carolina, but it was institutionalized racism in which nobody, well, I can't say nobody, but neither I nor I never had really thought it through. And when I started covering Dr. King and got to the point of we were seeing Ku Klux Klan rallies and seeing the violent, brutal, often lethal racism, I had never experienced anything like it in my life. And talking to Dr. King and listening to Dr. King, who was preaching a gospel of nonviolence, it changed me completely. I went from, first step was tolerance, second step was inclusion, and then became a strong believer in the absolute necessity of a broad and deep and continuing civil rights movement. That's the way it changed me.
Nice.
I want to do a follow-up question. I can't let you go without asking you about this, whether you think this is viable or not. But this is my new strategy. Assuming that bipartisan support is not in the cards for statehood, if Democrats win the Senate, and we see that there's a real chance of this, right? Ernst in Iowa, Collins in Maine, Graham in South Carolina, and others are in trouble. Do you think we could get the Senate to suspend the rule for cloture, which requires 60 votes, and invoke the nuclear option to pass D.C. statehood, referencing the Republicans' partisan push to have Amy Coney Barrett confirmed? In other words, arguing not to pack the court, but to pack the Senate with two more Democrats as kind of a political bulwark. I think that part of our problem has been we've never put anything in our fight for people that live outside D.C. But two more Democrats, that would be appealing to every Democrat, I think. What do you think?
I do think it would appeal to every Democrat. And I wish I could give you the answer you're looking for, that this is a good idea, and it's an idea whose time has come, and it's an idea that's going to be passed. I'm an optimist by nature and by experience, but I can't be optimistic about this. What you outlined would work if it could be done. I don't see the prospect of that happening with this next Senate. But having said that, we'll know more once we know how this next election is going to go. You know, do the Democrats get control of the Senate? If so, do they get control of the Senate with a very powerful control? All of those questions have to be answered before we know whether this is a doable idea in the near future. I wish I had a more optimistic answer, but I got to be realistic with you.
Well, we appreciate your honesty, and we also appreciate the honor of you being on our show. Because we're running out of time here.
One more quick plug, though, too. Yeah. The big interview with Dan Rather. Do you want to say a little bit about that before we go on AXS TV?
Well, I appreciate you giving me a chance to promote it. I do a program called The Big Interview. We can argue about how big an interview it really is, but that's the name of the program. We do The Big Interview. on AXIS is AXS TV, AXIS TV. It's a cable and satellite channel in which I interview frequently musicians and other people of accomplishment in the arts and sometimes in politics for an hour. Different kind of interview program, and I appreciate you mentioning it. It's called The Big Interview. It's on AXIS TV. And let me say, I've really enjoyed being with you this hour. Senator, it's good to make contact with you again. And Maria, yes. Again, congratulations on your anniversary. And I wish you both good luck and Godspeed.
And to you, thank you so much. Thank you.
Can I just mention that you will be in Washington on October 30th at Politics and Prose? And if you haven't read Dan Rather's book, you need to read it. It's a great book. Thank you so much for being with us and giving us the honor of this interview. At the end of every show, we leave with a song that we dedicate to our guests. Very often it's hard to pick one, but this one was really easy. So here for you, Dan Rather, legendary journalist and just a great gentleman and a wonderful person, is Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys with Deep in the Heart of Texas.
Give the people their right to vote.